five hindrances, and yesterday James talked about the five faculties, and I could today talk about the five skandhas, and that would leave it for Sylvia tomorrow to talk about the five thanksgivings. But I'll make passing reference to the five skandhas. I think maybe arguably the most chanted chant, sutra in Buddhism is called the Heart Sutra, which is a Mahayana sutra. It's chanted all the time in East Asia. And probably the most chanted because there's a lot more East Asian Buddhists than there are Southeast Asian Buddhists. And it's just short enough to be chanted in a, you know, in 5 minutes or so. There are monks in the monasteries in Japan who practice seeing if they could chant the whole thing on one breath. So it can be done pretty quickly. So, but it's the most famous sutra, and you find in Japan, you find cups with the Heart Sutra written on it, and clothes and underwear probably, and it's just a very, very popular sutra. And so this is the beginning, this is the opening line of the most famous sutra, which we should be respectful for. It starts, Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. When practicing deeply the Prajna Paramita, perceived that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering. And Prajna Paramita could be translated as Prajna can be translated as insight, paramita as usually as perfect, but complete, all-encompassing insight. And to me, it's significant that this famous sutra, the first line of it, begins with reference to Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva. Avalokiteshvara is the embodiment of compassion, Kuan Yin or Kanon. And so the beginning, I think, of practice, at least as much as we can, is compassion. And we see the world, we see ourselves, hopefully, through the eyes of compassion, to be able to be tender towards ourselves, forgiving, accepting. Because, you know, if we start the other, in Buddhism, there's two wings to Buddhism, the wisdom, the insight side, and the compassion side. And if we start with insight, we start with wisdom, it's all too easy to get too idealistic. And then once we're idealistic, we tend to maybe criticize ourselves or measure ourselves against it and just add suffering on top of suffering. So it's better to start with the actual rather than the ideal. And I think the instructions to start with compassion is more addressing the actual. It isn't that we can be automatically compassionate. Often we have idealistic ideas of what compassion is. But compassion is simply the tender quivering, the tender sense, the feeling of being in contact with pain and suffering. And it can come with sadness, it can come with sorrow, it can come with many different kinds of feelings, but that ability to be vulnerable and open and tender to the pain and the suffering is what compassion is, where compassion begins. So we start with that. To feel pain itself is to be Avalokiteshvara, is to be the Bodhisattva of compassion for ourselves. Somewhere or other, I came across a little quote that said, "If you can't love yourself, at least love the eyes that see. If you can't love yourself, at least love that which sees it all, sees that. At least, please don't make your practice, whether you call it a Buddhist practice or not, doesn't matter, but don't make your practice a cause for additional suffering. You know, the whole point of Buddhist practice, or your non-Buddhist practice, if you're here, is to help you become free of suffering. As it says in the opening of the Heart Sutra, to be saved from all suffering. So if that's the point of it all, the last thing you want to do is then engage yourself in a practice and use the practice for another excuse to beat yourself up. And to be upset and to kind of measure yourself against how well am I doing? Am I doing well enough? And, oh, I'm a terrible yogi because I'm not, you know, following enough breaths in a row or whatever. We add suffering on top of ourselves, when we're trying to do something, it's supposed to take away our suffering. So to the degree that it's possible, and I know that's maybe very, very not easy, please, please don't use your involvement with Buddhist practice as another source to feel bad about yourself. Absolutely not. So that means you never worry about what a Dharma teacher says. There's this poem by the Zen monk Soyen Shaku, and it starts with him saying one hut, and in Zen, the idea of one hut or the mountain is a place where it's kind of like identified with the monk or the nun themselves. So like to sit on top of the mountain, to sit in the hut, is to sit really, to sit in your seat of enlightenment, to sit in. So he writes, one hut built on the whole universe. From there, I can see mountains, rivers, and good earth as my own garden. Once I was annoyed with human language of good and bad, liking and disliking. I can hear those voices from here like music from paradise. So how do we see the language of good and bad? How do we see our suffering? Can we be open to our suffering and just simply feel compassionate for it? Or see it as music from paradise, if we're really lucky? Or if we're really lucky, we see it like what it said in the catalog I got in the mail last week. I never look at these catalogs. I don't get that many, probably as many as many people get. But I'm outraged. I get two or three a week. Is that a lot? Is a lot? Oh, I thought I was being spared. And I opened one of them and said, it was selling one of these home sweet home kind of signs. But on the sign it said, it's a blessing to be able to laugh at oneself, because then you'll never stop being amused. So compassion. And then the perfection of insight, prajnaparamita, the all-encompassing awareness which leaves nothing out. I talked the first night about the sacredness of awareness is the fact that it doesn't leave anything, there's no outside, everything's included within it. But what we learn very quickly when we do mindfulness practice is that our attention, our awareness, is often either incomplete or partial. That we focus on particular areas of our life at the exclusion of others. We're imbalanced often. And I think a lot of what we're coming to in mindfulness is a balanced sense of ourselves, not necessarily denying any part of ourselves, but rather bringing it all into a nice balance. But for example, one place that we're imbalanced for many of us is that we tend to give a lot of weight to the world of our thoughts. And so we get preoccupied in the world of our thoughts, and that's a place where we reside a good part of our life, in the commentary. Someone said that our primary addiction is to thoughts, to our thinking, to our mind. We think we are what we think, or we think what our thoughts tell us is true, or we think that what we think is significant. And it's phenomenal, you know, if you pay attention a little bit to your thoughts, as a few of you probably have this week. You know, if anybody else talked to me as much as I talk to myself, I would be totally bored and upset and wanting to get rid of them, to say it kindly. And not only that, but what is this person being so incredibly repetitive for? I've heard it now 500 times. But what I find most curious is that I don't get bored. Anybody else did it, I'd be bored, right? But I talk to myself, and it's totally interesting each time. It's like the first time. You know, and why is that? That what? Why is it that it's so compelling each time we think it? And I believe that part of it is because we identify with thoughts. That the world of thinking, what we think about, the subjects, thinking itself, is a place where it relates to our sense of identity. We get our identity from it. It relates to our identity. You know, if someone praises you, you wake up. If someone criticizes you, you kind of wake up. If they do neither, you fall asleep. Because our identity is kind of, I think, often works as kind of caffeine in the mind. And it gets things get agitated and busy and active because of the way we identify with so much. Sometimes I think that the tendency to fall asleep in meditation, there's many reasons. But sometimes I believe it occurs because people are so used to holding themselves, you know, having caffeinated, holding themselves excited and awake and going really strong by the propulsion of their thinking and their thoughts. And their thoughts begin to become a little bit quiet as they sit. And the caffeine isn't there in the usual way. They haven't found a non-thought addicted way of being energetic and being alive and present. So the tendency is to fall asleep until they can find that. So our thoughts. I sat the retreat earlier this year at Angela Center, and there was a courtyard in the middle, and I was walking, you know, back and forth in my walking meditation. And you know, I was thinking that some, you know. and I was going along, and you know, usually when you do walking meditation, you walk back and forth in the same walkway. So I came to the end of the walkway and I turned around, and I started walking back then in the same tracks where I'd just been. And so I took two steps back and realized, well, I'd just been there two seconds ago or 4 seconds ago. And then I thought, well, 4 seconds ago, I was completely preoccupied by this thought in this place. Where is it now? And I thought, well, gee, where is it now? Why was I so concerned 4 seconds ago with something that is already long gone? And the ephemeral nature of thoughts, how they're so insubstantial, became kind of stood out, was highlighted to me in this moment of walking meditation. It was highlighted to me how I was so preoccupied and caught up in it. It was so significant in the moment. But 4 seconds later, where was it? That which I was holding on to, so preoccupied with, where was it? Where do these thoughts of ours go? Where do they come from? They're the most insubstantial thing we have. Virtual reality. And actually, there's this beautiful expression, maybe from Tibetan Buddhism, of things self-liberating. Our thoughts are constantly self-liberating. But we're on to our next thought so quickly we haven't noticed. Mindfulness is not thoughtfulness, which is sometimes confused with. And people will think themselves into thinking they're mindful, or think themselves into the present moment. It's also not, mindfulness is sometimes confused with self-consciousness. And sometimes people have a tendency to be self-conscious, and especially self-critical, will sometimes get that tied up with just being mindful in a direct, non-evaluative way. So, for example, we get angry in sitting here, and a mindful reaction would be, oh, I'm angry. A self-conscious reaction would be, oh, shit, I'm angry. And there's a huge difference between those two. So we tend to imbalance our presence in life by giving so much credence and so much involvement with our commentary, our thoughts. And one of the antidotes, we can say, to the commentary, to thinking, is mindfulness of the body. After the Buddha died, shortly thereafter, someone came to Ananda, who was his attendant for many years, and said to Ananda, now that the teacher is gone, who is going to be our teacher? Who is going to be our friend? Maybe, I forget exactly, maybe it was more like, Now that our good friend, the Buddha, is gone, who's going to be our friend? Who's going to be our teacher? And Ananda replied, your body is your best friend now that the teacher is gone. And that's quite something to be said. Your body is now your best teacher. Your body now is your best friend. Your body is a guide to what is going on. What I've found is that my body has become one of the most trustable guides I have to what's going on within me. I first started paying attention to it when I was living in monastery, where I noticed that I could be very mindful of my thoughts and my mind in meditation, but not when I was out kind of working and interacting in the monastery. And then I noticed that if I made it a habit to drop into my body would tell me what I needed to know. It was much clearer, more obvious through my body, the movements of fear, of contraction, of joy, of openness, and what was going on. The body is kind of like an antenna, and it's quite sensitive to what's happening in our environment. It's also quite sensitive to what's happening within us, to our reactions, our emotions, our responses. And so by sensing what's happening in the body, we can be told, we can notice, oh, I'm afraid now, I'm happy now. And I do this a lot with my shoulders and my stomach, noticing when I'm tense. And my first indication for me that I'm tense in a situation sometimes can be my shoulders going up or my stomach kind of contracting. So the body can be a guide to what's happening. I learned more of this than when I sat an early retreat in Thailand with Ajahn Buddhadasa. At the end of a Dharma talk, he said kind of in passing, only to a few of us who were nearby, he said, don't do anything that takes you out of your body. And I thought that was very odd instructions at the time. And I didn't quite understand it, but I reflected on it. And in reflecting on it, I could feel and sense how through the course of the retreat, when I was in my body, properly balanced and centered, and when I was kind of in a sense out of my body, projected in front of me. I often tend to project it in front of me because I want to grasp onto things. You can see it often when the meal bell rings and it's time to go to meal. Where is your center of gravity, both of your balance and of your energy, when you're going to get food? You know, you're ahead of yourself, or there's two pieces left of the tofu and there's three people ahead of you in line, or one person ahead of you in line. Where is your center of gravity? Are you in your body? So I learned then to come back to my body, both to recognize what was going on, but also to reestablish some balance, to come back both in the physical balance, how I was sitting or how I was standing, but also energetically. So physically, you know, you can sit here and you can feel your sitting bones or your tailbones, and feel how the weight sits on your chair, on your cushion, and is it balanced? Are you leaning forward? Are you leaning back or to the side? As you go up the spine, how is the weight balanced there on the spine? Is it leaning forward so the center of gravity kind of goes down through the front of your chest? Or is the center of gravity kind of going through your spine as you're sitting there and through your neck? You can feel these things. And if you become sensitive to it as you sit, you become sensitive to the movements of the body that result from the way we react, the way we think, and the way we emote and feel. Also energetically, you can feel different places in the body, the energy moving. Certain kinds of energetic, emotional, or thoughtful kind of phenomena brings my energy up into my face or my upper torso. Some of it brings it into my stomach, into my shoulders. I can feel how I then get imbalanced rather than being balanced. So I can feel the energy. Just be aware of it. A lot of what mindfulness is, I feel, is bodyfulness, is embodiment. And you find in the early Buddha sutras a tremendous amount of emphasis on mindfulness on the body. Much more emphasis on mindfulness of the body than emphasis on mindfulness of breathing. The importance of being in the body, coming back in the body. And this body that we have, isn't that we're supposed to be aware of it? The body we have is an awareness. It's not so dualistic, it's not so separate, like we're up here in the head watching the body and being aware of it. But if you open and relax and sense, you'll feel the body is an awareness, is a sense organ, it is an antenna. And it's, in a sense, maybe not separate from anything. So sometimes we can say it makes sense to give instructions to open into the body, to open the body, to open to the breath. And for those of you who that kind of little instruction works, you maybe feel a little settling, a little openness, a little opening of the chest or of the body or the torso, and to open and receive what's going on. And then to live in body time rather than mind time. Many of us here now have slowed down quite a bit in the middle of the retreat. But you see mind time very clearly outside the retreat when we're trying to do 3 or 4 or 10 different things at once. And we're running ahead of ourselves. We're not even in the present moment. We're certainly not in our body. But we're rushing ahead, making deadlines. And we're in world time and busy time and mind time. What is it to be in the body's time, to discover the time that the body wants to live? If we're running around trying to do 10 things at once and meet 3 deadlines all at once, you're not going to be in the body's time. You're in your thoughts, your ideas of schedules and projects and expectations. But what does the body want to do if you give it a chance? Settle down. Body time. And the opportunity on retreat, I believe, is to begin living much more connected to body's time rather than mind time. And to slow down slow enough, quiet enough, to really let your coming, your manifestation, your coming forth into life, come out of your body, rather than come out of your thoughts and your ideas of where you should be and what's supposed to be happening. So the tremendous emphasis that we tend to give on slowing down throughout your activities on the retreat, getting up, I mean, you might experiment sometime. Some of you maybe have never done this kind of really slow practice throughout the day. You might do it as an experiment. See if it can take you 10 minutes to stand up and get out to the door. Can you make it that slow and see what happens? Maybe that's too slow for you, but to go really slow and find out what happens when you connect to the body from the inside through slowing down. Part of the value of coming back to the body is the body is always in the present moment. So by returning to the body, we're helping to regain this proper balance between the mind and the body. There's tremendous gravitational force pulling us into our thoughts, the gravitational force of identification. And every time you come back into the present moment in a full way, you overcome, you balance, you counteract that gravitational force. And one way to come back into the present moment repeatedly in a clear and consistent way is to come back into the body, to feel the breath, to feel the body, what's happening right now. The way of being in the present. I've noticed in myself that sometimes when I'm a little bit imbalanced, in a sense, with my practice, that my practice gets in the way of me being present. And here I am trying to do a practice that's supposed to make me present. And I'm so intent on becoming concentrated or so intent on getting somewhere with my breath or getting a certain state of mind or something, or just so intent on something, maybe I don't even know what I'm to intent for, that I've missed the fact that it's already happening. And so practice, don't let your practice get in the way of being present. If you notice that, then let go of your practice and relax into the present moment. The body. In one of the early Buddhist texts, maybe it's a sutra, I'm not sure, there's a wonderful expression where it says, the body arises from intention and is to be felt. And I don't want to make it an absolute statement, but so much of how we experience our body arises from intentions, holding patterns. We experience, there's tightness in the shoulders. And there was an intention behind that tightness. There was an intention that responding to perhaps fear or greed or desire. That our responses and reactions are very subtle perhaps, but there's intention at the source of it. There's a choice. We come to a moment of choice and might be almost unconscious, but we intend to go in a direction of maybe fear, and so the shoulders go up. And so then, so that much of our experience of the body is a result of intention. So that's all fine. And then the instruction is simply, and is to be felt. Not it's to be judged, not to be, you know, supposed to do a little bit of yoga and stretch it out, or it just simply says the body rises from intention and is to be felt. To feel it very carefully, to allow it to be there. Because the body itself is, in Buddhism, is not understood as being a static thing, a kind of permanent, unfixed thing. The body is a process. But what holds the process in check is our identification, usually with thoughts and thinking. We're preoccupied. It might be very, very subtle. We can't see it always. But identification with thoughts, or the way we think often, where we identify with motions and feelings, that is the way in which the body's held in check, held frozen in a sense. But if we bring awareness and feel our body, sense it, like a sensory awareness exercise, sense it from the inside, that allows, begins to allow the thawing, begins to allow the process of the body to have its turn, to kind of process itself. Sometimes mindfulness is described as turning a light on in a dark room. And that's a nice metaphor. But the metaphor that I like now is a little bit different, and that is, it's like turning on a light in a greenhouse. Because you turn a light on, light in itself, you know, you can say maybe is non-interfering awareness. You're not interfering, you're not judging, you're not manipulating. You're allowing things to be as they are. But if you turn it on in the room, well, it's all very fine for the furniture. If you turn it on in the greenhouse, and the plants begin to grow, and the mildew on the leaves maybe begins to dry out. And I believe that's what happens when we bring light of awareness to our life and feel our body, feel our emotions, sense our thoughts, is that the wholesome aspects of our life are the process, the flow of our life begins to move. And that which is frozen, maybe ever so slowly, but it begins to thaw. So I think a greenhouse is maybe a better analogy. However, I've gotten curious lately about how sometimes bringing awareness to our clingings and our holdings, our obsessions, our addictions, places we are caught, is not often enough to let the thawing kind of begin happening, to let the processing begin. And I think sometimes we're very clever. We can see how we hold and cling, but we're very clever in rationalizing it, in justifying it, saying that, oh, I need to do this because then I can be more efficient, or it's safer if I do this, my life will be safer if I hold on, or this is how I have an identity, this is who I am, and so I can't let go of it because then who would I be? There's many, many ways we justify letting the holding be, even if we can see it clearly. And sometimes we have to take a wider look and see, what is that subtle justification that holds it in place, that doesn't allow us to kind of open to the process again? So feeling all these things in the body, feeling our life in our body. And today, James gave the instructions on mindfulness of thoughts, of commentary, of the stories. And I think it's important not to make our thinking life a problem, but to actually be friends with our thoughts also, to be friends with everything. The difficulty is not in the world of thoughts, you know, in and of themselves. The difficulty is how we identify with them, and they become these black holes for our awareness. The light of awareness gets sucked up into them, and doesn't come out. It's the way I talked about the hindrances. It isn't that sensual desire or aversion or restlessness are problematic in and of themselves, but it's the gravitational force of identification that sucks up the light of our awareness and it doesn't come out. So we don't have to be against the hindrances. We're simply trying to avoid the hindering quality of them. Our thoughts, you know, I feel tremendously friendly and appreciative of my thoughts. I don't see them as being a problem. The problem for me is when I identify with them that I cannot be present fully to what's actually happening now. And that might be thinking. So for example, it's a very cute thing, you know, be here now, right? So then you think simplistically, well, I can't think about the past or the future then. And so you kind of yank yourself out of the past or you yank yourself out of the future to be here now. But it's simpler than that. All you have to do is to be aware that you're thinking about the future, thinking about the past now. That's what's happening in the present moment. So if thoughts are in the background of awareness, and the foreground of awareness is your breath or whatever else, it's fine, just leave them in the background, don't make them a problem. It's when they come into the foreground of attention that way they become the subject of mindfulness. And as it was said, you know, if they're relatively weak and you kind of notice them, weak means if identification with them is weak, then just bringing awareness to them is bringing something, part of us, which is not identifying, and often it dissolves identification, and the thoughts will often dissolve if it's weak. But sometimes the thoughts are much more compulsive, much stronger, maybe obsessive, or just kind of unrelenting, or very repetitive over and over again. There's a few things that can be done when that's the case. The idea is not to get rid of it, but rather the idea is to bring mindfulness so we can really see it clearly without identification. Oh, this is energetic thinking. This is active thinking. Rather than getting caught up in the story of what we're thinking about. And one of the ways to do this is to feel the phenomena of compulsive or strong, addicted thinking, to feel it in the body. Again, coming back to the body. Whatever, so often in the practice we can turn ourselves back into our body, what's going on physically, in what we're experiencing right now. So with our thinking life, turn ourselves back into the body and what's happening in relationship to thinking in our body. Because if it's compulsive, if it's very strong and continual, almost certainly you'll find there's a physical element to it. There's, you know, when people are really thinking hard, you know, you see this little frown, you know, between their eyebrows. It's physical, right? Often there's a kind of a tightness or constriction someplace in the body, or heaviness or pressure. That's at least the way I often feel it in myself. And to feel the physicality of that, not the story, not getting lost in the story, but what is it preoccupation actually feel like physically? To sense that and just be there with it, not to get rid of it, but sense it and feel it, and then you're there present for it without getting lost in the story, identifying with it. And the tendency is when you bring the light onto it like that, it begins to release itself, but that's not the point. The point is to be present for what's happening. And as I said earlier, you can feel it sometimes in the balance in your body. When you're preoccupied with thoughts, what's happening to your balance? Are you balanced gravitationally with your weight? Are you balanced energetically? Or is there imbalance now in the body that represents or comes out of that kind of preoccupation? As we do this physical exploration, part of that might be the discovery that particular storyline is associated with some kind of emotion, because that emotion's happened in the body. So then you notice perhaps that you've been planning over and over again for the last 3 days or the last 3 hours or whatever. It's a repetitive theme. And you notice, oh, that planning, oh, you feel it in your body, what that planning's like. And perhaps you find that there's apprehension or fear that's fueling that planning. And if you don't acknowledge the fear or the apprehension, that fear, the apprehension, is going to be a factory that's just going to spit out more planning thoughts. That's what it likes to do. And if we're very good in note planning, 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 and the planning goes away, we haven't really noticed the fear. If we haven't, then it spits out another planning thought. And this, you know, this kind of phenomenon is common with very repetitive thoughts. So noticing what the repetitive pattern is, and is there an emotion that seems, not to analyze and figure out what it might be, but really to sense from the inside what else is going on here in the body. And then you might feel, oh, there's some emotion connected to it. Sometimes I think of very, very repetitive thoughts that keep reappearing as being little flags waving at us, saying, hey, something you're supposed to notice here, but you're not. And so sometimes it's something in the body, something emotional. The other thing we can do with compulsive or very strong patterns of thinking is we can become aware, we can study or become aware of the quality of the inner voice that's thinking. How do we talk to ourselves? You know, if a lot of what's going on in our thoughts is kind of self-talk, what is the quality of that within our mind? Is it soft? Is it loud? Is it hesitant? Is it harsh? Is it loving, soothing? Is it fearful or angry? Is it desperate? Is it effortful? Is it full of effort? Or is it effortless to be involved in this kinds of preoccupation, these kinds of thoughts? Just to sense that. Again, all these things are things that can be sensed and felt. What is a sense, what is a felt sense of the quality of that kind of repetitive thinking, or the quality of your self-talk? What is it actually like when we think the way we do? If it's painful in there, then you should remember that pain or suffering is the proximate cause for compassion. So if you feel that it's a lot of suffering in there, it's okay to feel that suffering. It's okay to feel the pain. And then perhaps you'll feel some compassion for yourself or for those voices. And whatever the quality is of that self-talk, that's the thinking, again, you can turn it back into the body. So you feel the softness, you feel the harshness, you feel the effort, you feel the effortlessness, you feel the fear. You can feel that again in the body. What does it feel like in the body? Maybe you feel it, maybe it's in the head primarily. Many of us, we think in our head. So there's a lot of sensations there. Are there sensations associated with the quality of this voice? One of the most important forms of holding, of clinging, and clinging and holding or grasping is the source of suffering, is identification. Somehow holding on to something as if this is who I am, or this relates to who I am, or this. And this is often easier to see in others than it is in ourselves. And maybe it's not fair to teenagers, but I thought of this example. You know, often we see some teenagers who are tremendously identified with certain aspects of themselves. You know, for example, they're zits. and they're completely mortified to show themselves in school or to their friends, or a certain kind of clothes, or to be with their parents. You know, there's certain kinds of identifications which are so important. You know, you'll die if you know if anybody sees you this way or is known. And then we go along in our life and we get older and older, you know, and after a while we don't care anymore if we have a little zit on our chin. You know, when our whole sense of identity and self-worth isn't tied up in zits anymore. And so we look back and say, oh, wow, you know, that was maybe an unnecessary kind of identity. You know, how much suffering that was. I'm so glad I'm not lost in that kind of world again. And there's a lot of wisdom that comes with aging. And I think that a lot of what Buddhist practice is about is accelerated aging. So the Buddha talked about five different places that we tend to where we get identified. Kind of, it's kind of a helpful way of understanding where we tend to get caught with identification. And identification is not the same thing as identity. Many of us have, you know, identities, all kinds of identities. You know, I'm a husband, I'm a man, I'm a student, I'm a teacher, I'm this and that. And, you know, some of these things are just the way things, you know, I'm not going to deny that I'm a man. But I have an identity, but for me to identify with being a man, you know, watch out. All of you, you know. If being a man is really good at that, you know. And being a man means I have to, you know, have a Lexus. and I don't have a Lexus. So a friend of mine lets me drive the Lexus. And suddenly my happiness, you know, the joy arises out of, you know, finally people can see me, who I really am, the man I really am. And the joy arises because there's this evaluation, this identification arises there first. Or then, the Lexus is taken back. And and now I feel sad because now, you know, that I know, you know, who I think I'm supposed to be is no longer being supported, and no one's going to see me who I really am anymore. And that's sad. And I feel kind of angry or upset or whatever. So many emotions we have, not all, but so many, arise out of some way in which we identify with a self. Some self-evaluation that's involved. So the Buddha had five areas, and these are called the five skandhas. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply the perfection of insight, perceived that all five skandhas are empty and was saved from all suffering. This is what Avalokiteshvara kind of is aware of. We look through the eyes of compassion. What we look at in our practice is we look at our identification. It's one of the things we see. It isn't like you notice that you're identifying and, oh, I'm not doing a practice, I'm not really a good Buddhist, and I'm supposed to be without it. And this is what the stuff of practice is, to notice this stuff, to notice it with compassion, with acceptance. This is what a human being does, to see it. Good and bad, liking and disliking, identifying and not identifying. I can hear these as voices, like music from paradise. The five skandhas. So the five skandhas are the five places of identification. Its first one is form, or our body. The second is feelings. The third is our perceptions. It could also be our opinions, because those are closely related often. And the fourth is, it's a much bigger kind of vague category, but it's our motivations, our dispositions, the ways we think about things, our thoughts, our judgments, our evaluations. And then the fifth is consciousness, is awareness itself. And all these are five different places of where we tend to get attached. And this is who I am. So if you think the body is who if I think the body is who I am, I'll probably spend next weekend either at the, you know, at Macy's, you know, maybe the cosmetic counter, or at the gym. Because, you know, it's really important with, you know, that the body that I have to be, that I am. Descartes, you know, who said, I think, therefore I am, he was probably identified with the fourth skandha. And if you identify with your opinions, your perceptions, this is the way things are, then you're identified with the third skandha. And awareness is one of the, consciousness itself is one of the great traps to be identified, to hold on, to cling to, make a self out of our consciousness itself. And this movement to create identification is a movement of contraction, is a movement of holding, of clinging. And if our awareness gets stuck anywhere through this contraction, we will always suffer. The definition of dukkha in Buddhism is it's a kind of suffering that arises out of the holding, the contraction that happens. Tight holding. You can hold things kind of lightly with a light touch. That's okay. But it's a, you know, it's a grasping on tight. This fourth skandha of dispositions, of impulses, of inner kind of thoughts and ideas, what happens there is we identify with certain parts of it, and not other parts. Sometimes we identify with the problematic parts of ourselves. This is who I am. You know, I'm always a fearful person. I'm always such a critical person. I'm always this way. Or we identify very strongly with the non-problematic side, which we're not. We choose one side over the other. The identification, there's two things I wanted to say about this. It's almost always arises out of comparative thinking. We compare ourselves to something else. We compare ourselves to an ideal, or we compare ourselves to other people. And as many of you probably heard, the Buddha defined conceit as three ways. Conceit is, for sure, it's considering ourselves superior to others, but it's also considering ourselves inferior to others. And it's also considering ourselves equal to others. All those three are conceit because they all involve creating identification of comparison. And so the koan then is, especially here in America, we're all supposed to be equal. How can we be equal without comparing ourselves to anybody? Without needing to be equal? But it's measuring our... Identification often comes by measuring our actions and speech in terms of some idea we have. This is the way I'm supposed to be. This is the way I'm not supposed to be. Internalized ideas. You know, if I think that I'm supposed to be... You know, I kind of like to play basketball sometimes and shoot the hoops. And I'm a lousy basketball player. Boy, am I ever lousy. Compared to what? Compared to Michael Jordan? Compared to the 8-year-old that sometimes I play with? Where does this idea come from? It's a comparative idea. I, you know, sometimes the ball goes in and sometimes it doesn't. That's what's actually happening. And there's proportions of times and statistics to be had, but the idea of I'm a lousy player, make that identity, that's a measurement, that's a judgment. So what are we comparing ourselves with? Do we notice that? We're comparing ourselves with the other yogi next to us who hasn't moved at all in the last 3 days. And there's mildew growing from their ears. Or are we identifying with the person who is moving all the time and we're not moving? And you know, or are we comparing ourselves? How do we compare ourselves? What are we comparing ourselves to? And these are two of my favorite quotes. It's said sometimes that Dharma teachers basically teach what they need to hear themselves. So I like these two quotes a lot, but I never read them together because they're saying the same thing.